regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, this is Nate Kaczmarek, Director of the Regulatory Transparency Project, and I'm pleased to have Wen Fa joining us for an RTP Explainer podcast. Wen, how are you today?
Doing well.
Well, it's great to once again have you with us. For our audience, Wen is an attorney with PLF. He has litigated numerous cases dealing with private property, equality under the law, school choice, economic liberty, and the First Amendment, among others. He holds a bachelor's from the University of Texas at Dallas and a master's in political theory from the London School of Economics. And his law degree is from the University of Michigan Law School. We've invited Wen on today to discuss specifically equality in government contracting.
Yeah, definitely. So let me just back up a little bit and talk about what government contracting is. So I think we all remember Elizabeth Warren, I think it was during the 2012 elections, said something like, you didn't build that. Well, actually, when you're talking about public roads and public schools, the government officials don't literally build that as either. They contract with private companies, construction companies that perform the work for them. So these are incredibly important jobs, people who build public schools, public hospitals, and public roads, and perform an essential function for people all across the United States. Unfortunately, there are a lot of programs at the federal, state, and local level that call for racial preferences and racial set-asides in government contracting. Those programs usually say something to the effect of 25% of dollars in construction will go to businesses that are designated as minority-owned businesses. And while there's nothing wrong with removing barriers for small businesses to compete, racial discrimination and racial quotas in contracting is just as wrong and just as unconstitutional as racial preferences and racial quotas in other contexts like education. So in March, the Department of Labor rescinded some of its affirmative action rules in response to the coronavirus pandemic. There are many other racial preferences at the state and local level. Right now, we haven't had any action by them in suspending these requirements, but I think state and local governments should take a hard look at these racial preferences and say that we're just going to do away with them and allow people to compete as individuals and let the best person for the job get that job.
So when you mentioned the Labor Department's action, was that ostensibly their justification for these waivers? Was that to speed up the process in order to remove, you know, barriers to getting certain contracts done and certain people working on COVID response?
It was. I think the federal government recognized that in times of COVID, we definitely need people to not just build the roads, build the schools, and build the hospitals. We need the providers to be able to supply the government and then the American people with things like face masks, medical supplies, and so forth. So whenever you put arbitrary racial barriers to the supply chain, you're going to get less of it because people aren't going to be focused as much about having those supplies go to the public. They're going to say, well, are we ensuring that 25% of the suppliers are minority-owned businesses? And, you know, that's arbitrary in any time, but especially so when we're in the middle of a pandemic.
The pandemic has a way of focusing on people on quality and speed rather than some of these other considerations.
Absolutely.
So good, very interesting. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about some of the specific state or local programs that you feel could benefit from a similar sort of waiver action or permanent, permanently rescinding those policies across the country.
Sure. As I mentioned previously, these programs exist on multiple levels, on the federal level, on the state level, and on the local level. I think my first call to action would be to say to those state and local governments that are thinking about enacting these racial quotas to reconsider. You have the city of South Bend, for example, Mayor Pete, saying that these racial quotas would benefit the people of South Bend. I completely disagree. I think individual treatment and individualism actually benefits everyone. And racial quotas, and city governments should be focused on solutions, not quotas. As far as programs that are currently in existence, you have places like the city of Chicago, for instance, that have had some sort of racial preference in contracting since 1986. And while the Supreme Court has ostensibly told governments that want to discriminate on the basis of race that there should be a sunset period, the city of Chicago has, like many other places, revamped its racial preferences every 5 years. And now it still has a system of racial preferences in government contracting. So those are some of the places, some of the examples that I'll mention. But like I said, these racial quotas are rampant across America, and it's really time for the government to stop treating people as members of racial groups and to start treating people as individuals.
And those programs, help me out. They're known as minority business enterprise programs. Is that right?
Right. So there's a few different types of terminology in describing these programs. Some call them minority business enterprise programs. Other governments call them disadvantaged business enterprise programs. And what these programs, even when they're phrased as disadvantaged business programs, they give a presumption of disadvantage to anyone who is a member of a racial minority. So in a lot of these, when you look at a lot of these programs, if you are a business owner and you make below a certain income, I don't think there's any problem with just saying that those businesses are disadvantaged. But when you say that I'm disadvantaged because I'm Asian, or I'm disadvantaged because I'm a Hispanic-owned business, without individualized proof, I think that really threatens the concept of individual treatment and requires the government to start thinking about group-based action. The type of preferences that people are getting are based on their membership in a racial group, and that's just something that's very un-American.
And some would argue unconstitutional, right?
Certainly, the Supreme Court of the United States has made it absolutely clear that racial programs need to be narrowly tailored to address a compelling interest. And the only compelling interest in this field is an interest in remedying past discrimination. So if you had a contractor that was actually discriminated against on the basis of race, there's nothing to prevent the government to remedy that discrimination. But what governments have done is that there's been a cottage industry of what are called disparity studies. Basically, the government will pay these, there are about half a dozen of these firms across the country that will do disparity studies for the government, basically telling the government what they want to hear. And what they want to hear is that there is some sort of disparity in contracting that justifies the use of racial preferences. And it's very alarming that year after year, despite the fact that a lot of the state and local governments have had these programs for decades now, they persist in having these minority business enterprise programs and having these racial quotas. In reality, if these quotas have not helped to remedy discrimination for the last three decades, there's no reason to believe that they will somehow be effective in remedying discrimination anytime soon.
And based on that, have we seen across the country people filing suit to challenge these preferences in contracting?
You know, we have not. There are a couple of cases that every law student and every lawyer knows, and there are cases such as Croson and Adiran, and those are some of the biggest Supreme Court cases dealing with equality before the law. And those cases highlight that the fact that racial preferences need to be carefully scrutinized by the court, even when those racial preferences are in the context of contracting. But since those cases, lower courts have really endorsed these disparity studies, and they have not been consistent at all with enforcing the command of cases like Croson. The problem is these cases, cases vindicating equality in contracting are very difficult to litigate. They are expensive. They require, in many cases, expert testimony. So many contractors who just want to do their job simply don't have the resources to litigate them. But that certainly doesn't mean that these preferences racial preferences in contracting are compatible with the Constitution. In fact, they violate the constitutional principle of equality before the law.
I'm curious about both ends of the spectrum. Do you have examples currently of any states proactively looking to remove these sorts of regulations on their own? And then also, do you have any sense of states that are pushing in the other direction or municipalities that are looking to grow these sorts of programs?
It's very much a one-way ratchet. States that have these programs, they want to keep them. They're usually not very effective, as I mentioned before, but they are, in many cases, very politically salient and politically popular. On the other hand, there are many municipalities that are trying to enact these programs. You have South Bend, as I mentioned earlier, with Mayor Pete lauding these programs as something that the city of South Bend should adopt. You have places like Columbus, where the mayor implemented an emergency order that said, in light of the coronavirus pandemic, you need these sort of racial quotas. Exactly the opposite is true. As the federal government has illustrated with its temporary waiver back in March, when you have a situation that really calls on getting the right supplies to the right people, you should open up the marketplace. You should adopt, it's a better time than ever to adopt free market principles and say that we encourage people of all races, of all backgrounds, we just encourage people to give us what we need, to give us the supplies that we need as a good product and at a quality price.
So it's interesting, the pandemic is being responded to in exactly opposite ways in this context. You have some government officials reacting to the pandemic and setting them aside for a brief period, and then you have others that are pointing as reason that we need to double down on these policies.
Certainly, and these programs cost taxpayers, I would say in some cases, millions of dollars, not just because you have the additional expenses required to meet the quotas of qualified minority businesses in some cases, but in other instances, they have led to rampant fraud. You've heard stories in Washington State, for example, an 8-month-long news investigation found that some disadvantaged business enterprises, which haul in millions of dollars worth of government contracts, were blatantly gaming the system. In some cases, they were obtaining contracts because of their minority status, only to have larger companies perform the actual work. And, you know, I think that's something that's really hurtful for businesses of all types to have this sort of fraud and corruption in the contracting industry.
Well, and like most regulatory
policies. Likely you need people within the government who are going to process and verify these businesses and enforce these new rules in order to, you know, verify that they're complying with these new laws. So presumably there's an extra set of bureaucrats attached to each one of these new programs at each level.
There absolutely is. There are bureaucrats, not just, as you mentioned, to process the paperwork and to make sure that people are complying with these programs, but there are also bureaucrats that are in charge of determining a person's race when a person applies as a minority-owned business. And, you know, just to talk a little bit more about the pernicious effects of that, you have a case from back in, I believe it was 2014, where the EEOC, in another race case, hired five race raiders, and they looked at the driver's licenses for people to determine if there were sufficient allegations of racial discrimination. And what happened was they all looked at the driver's licenses independently, and in over 10% of the cases, they reached different results on the race of the person that they examined. And I think that's gives more credence to the thought that the government should not be looking at people based on race. They should not be determining a person's race. They should treat everybody as individuals based on that person's individual circumstances rather than membership in a racial group.
Are there any other things you'd like to highlight with regard to this topic?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mentioned a little bit about the effects of these sorts of programs on the public and on people who rely on the government to build public schools and public roads and public hospitals. But let's talk about the contractors themselves, because I think these programs really hurt a lot of people whose lifelong passion it is to go into contracting. You have contractors who are denied the opportunity to compete just because they are of the wrong race. And you have, you know, even minority contractors. There are stories of minority contractors who, at the end of the project, feel abused by this process because someone hired them to meet this racial quota and then ended up not really using their work. So this program is extremely harmful to the public contractors of America, to those people who devote their lives to building. And, you know, we hope that it will soon be ended for good.
Well, are there reasons for optimism? Do you think that there can be influence made on local decision makers, or do you see the most realistic route for getting change with regard to these preferences coming through the courts?
Well, I think I'm very optimistic, but I also agree that the most realistic avenue for change is probably through the courts, because a lot of these programs have existed for decades and there's no reason to think that they'll stop existing now. But I think I am optimistic about the courts, because we have seen in the last decade the court being willing to take up a lot of these race issues regarding racial preferences. We've seen cases coming from the University of Michigan, cases coming from the University of Texas. There are cases involving racial preferences at Harvard and University of North Carolina that are working their way up in the court system right now. And, you know, if racial preferences in education is wrong, there's no reason for the court to endorse racial preferences in public contracting. So I think there's definitely hope for contractors and for people affected by racial discrimination in the field of contracting as well.
Well, that's excellent. And we will have to keep close track of it. And of course, come back to you when we have updates that we'd like to highlight for our audience. On behalf of RTP, I'd just like to thank you, Wen, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.